Over a hill and under a misty mountain, deep within the unceded Musqueam territory of Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Doug Vandelay with another episode of Comedy Zeitgeist. You can follow the show on Twitter at Comedy Zeitgeist and pester me at Doug Vandelay. Hello to everybody listening on CITR 101.9 here for the first 30 minutes of the show. Host of Pulling the Trigger and Comedy Shocker, I'm joined today by amateur ferret wrangler Mark Hughes. How's your day going, Mark?
So far, so good, actually. And I have four ferrets now, so I'm almost I'm semi-professional. Yeah, I'm not an amateur anymore. I'm actually, one of them's just a loner, though, so.
That was going to be my first question, if you actually do keep ferrets, or that was just a bit.
I have three ferrets that are mine, and I'm currently ferret-sitting one.
Really?
Yeah.
How many ferrets are there that you get to ferret sit? Is it just like once you keep ferrets, people know you have them?
Pretty much. It's a small little community, yeah. And the thing about ferrets is when you travel or anything like that, or you need, it's better to have someone who knows how to deal with ferrets because they're a very unique animal. So, and not a lot of people are familiar with them unless they're familiar with them. It's not like a dog or a cat where everyone's seen one before. So it ends up being like, and they're destructive. And they are can be very. You have to really love ferrets to love ferrets. They're really cute to look at, but as soon as you, if you ever try to just like have one and just like impulse bought one at a pet store, 90% of people would be like, I can't handle this animal.
What kind of challenges do you have with a?
Well, see that chair behind you? They would wreck that chair. They'd dig up the cushion, rip it open, or they'd try and get in. They'd get in there. They steal things. They wreck. They dig up that plant.
So do you have to like keep them in a cage or something?
No, I just let them run around and I sacrifice any kind
of... You just got no furniture?
Yeah, not really. No, I got a couch that's all fucked up. Can I swear?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Cool. Are we live right for the first half?
No. I mean, I should have said that beforehand. So what it is is the first 30 minutes I do an edit and send into the radio each week. It's on at Monday at 6 o'clock on CITR 101.9.
Oh, cool.
But I always forget to let people know that it's on at the time.
Right.
I'll remember it about 7 p.m. when it's already half an hour gone.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, so this show will be Monday week because next Monday will be last week's guest, which was...
So it'll be...
Yeah, we're a
week ahead.
But anyway, for the listeners, could you tell us a bit about Comedy Shocker?
Comedy Shocker is Western Canada's premier and pretty well only XXX rated dark and dirty comedy show. It's no holds barred, no topic off limits. The more controversial subject or dirty or inappropriate matter, that's what we want. That's the type of thing we're going for.
And that's like a stand-up nine?
Yeah, stand-up. Yeah, it's completely stand-up.
What kind of stuff comes up there?
Rape,
you wouldn't hear?
Race, Holocaust, abuse, drug use, trans issues, immigration, anything that you're sort of quote-unquote not allowed to joke about or talk about normally, we joke about at that show.
Do you find that people generally just being free about their comedy or pushing the envelope because they know they can as well?
Both.
Yeah?
I think a lot of comedians, not all, but a lot, want to push the envelope, but because of many influences, industry, community, social, they don't. They just kind of, sometimes they'll write jokes and just never do them, and then our show in certain ways gives them the opportunity to do them. But then there's just comics who tell dirty jokes or tell inappropriate jokes, and that's just sort of more their style, and they're not necessarily trying to push the envelope. It's just that's just the joke that ends up coming out.
So in a way it's kind of like in its own way, a safe space for the comic.
It's the exact opposite of a safe space in the usual sense, yeah.
But it's a safe space for the comic rather than the audience, in a way.
To a degree, yeah. I guess that's a good way of looking for it. But the audience that we get wants to see that kind of comedy. They're paying. The only complaint we ever get about the Comedy Shocker from audience is that it wasn't offensive enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's hard to find comedians who are willing to, because first of all, you got to work on the material. Where do you work on it? In regular comedy shows where you could get the show shut down if it's a bar or something like that, or you might get banned. So you got that bridge to cross. Then you have the social pressures. Comedians can actually be the worst for trying to censor comedy.
Really?
In this day and age, yeah. No. The amateur level comedians and some even semi-pro levels can be the worst for actually trying to censor comedy. If it's any kind of controversy, they tend to. Because in Canada, at a certain level, most comedy is operated and produced by comics themselves. So And my dime store psychological analysis is that comics tend to be kind of people pleasers, and they're scared of others. We want approval, right? Yeah. That's why we're doing this, right? So if they think we want approval and we don't want disapproval. So this day and age, what gets you disapproval? Anything that kind of contradicts the identity politics or social justice issues or anything like that. So any comedians who joke about stuff like that, that there could be potential backlash, comedians get scared that they'll be lumped in with it. They're scared that they'll be lumped in with it, or B, they're scared that if they don't say anything or do anything, they'll be considered complicit in it, right? So what they do is they end up like, you see comedians like banning other comics from shows, sometimes justifiably, because sometimes the comics material is so rough that it's just not really suitable. But it's just as often it's this sort of, it's not official censoring in the usual sense. It's just more this sort of social alienation or ostracization that happens.
So do you think there's like quite a large divide in comedians in BC between people who might go to a more mainstream show here in the lower mainland?
I would say in Vancouver, the way the comedy scene works is that there's 10, 15, 20 very established, very good comics, and they sort of set the precedent for what comedy is supposed to look like in Vancouver. So if you do anything outside of that, it ends up looking, I wouldn't say necessarily bad, but it's definitely different. It seems different.
Yeah.
So as soon as you break from that sort of standard, it isolates you. And when I say isolate, I don't necessarily mean in a bad way, but you're different. So which way does the different go is the next question, right? So a guy like me, because I don't joke about or use, my style is quite a bit different than the sort of norm, as it were, to a certain degree, not always. That's the other thing. Comedy isn't a static thing.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as a dirty comic in its truest sense, because each joke lives on its own, or each bit lives on its own. One bit could be dirty or controversial, then you move into the next bit and it's not. Is the person doing that a dirty comic or not?
Yeah.
It's not like music where you have a heavy metal act who does hip hop sometimes. They do heavy metal all the time.
Right.
Comedy, it's joke by joke, bit by bit. And it's whatever the comic has come. There's comics who do dirty comedy, but also do political comedy or observational comedy, right? So, but for the sake of marketing, and we need labels, so people get labeled dirty comedy, dirty comics. So what ends up happening is, as a guy like me who does dirty or dark or edgy comedy, I end up standing out, and for better or for worse.
I saw on your Twitter, I can't remember if it was your tweet or something you retweeted, but that a lot of comics in Vancouver end up moving to LA.
A lot of comics end up moving out of Vancouver.
Yeah. Do you think that's a problem, that if there isn't a space for someone, that they will move, or do you think it's more that they're just trying to excel their career?
It's both. Vancouver's limited in its population size. There's only so far you can go. I've had this conversation a couple times a day. For just to use a round number, it's completely arbitrary. There's only, let's say, 20 available spots for paid work in Vancouver. There's probably more, but just so you can get a concept of it. If there's only 20 paid spots, there's more comics than that, what do you do? And I find Vancouver audiences, it's difficult to get them to come out to comedy, generally speaking. So it starts becoming like, if you want to produce and perform, you can do it. But often one will be more work than the other. And one of those two will suffer as a result of the other. So if I want to focus on production and do show and promotion and stuff, I can do that. But then I might not be able to do my comedy. I have to be on top of that part, on top of the ads on Facebook, the postering, the whatever else someone does, Instagram campaign, all that stuff for production. So you got to be really on top of it. And I might not, it's a different gear than creativity and performing, right? So then often it's just very difficult to kind of run shows and do them here. And there's only so many places to get hired, as it were. So people end up moving to more populated areas, generally LA or New York. Some Toronto too, to a certain degree.
So you also have a one-man show, Tragedy plus Time equals Comedy.
Time Served equals Comedy.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's right.
Tragedy plus Time Served equals Comedy.
What can you tell us about that?
It's basically the show about my life. So I just talk about how I was recovering at, I'm a former street kid, formerly homeless, formerly drug addicted, formerly imprisoned, ex-convict, da-da-da-da-da, and how I got into all that and then how I came out of it.
And you still perform that one?
All the time. I'm in the Nanaimo Fringe in August.
So you have some interesting guests on Pulling the Trigger.
Yeah.
From sex workers to famous comedians.
Yeah.
What's your process for preparing an episode?
I kind of wing it.
Yeah.
I don't really think about the questions beforehand. I kind of just let the conversation happen organically. I tend to have ideas of what I'm going to ask them prior a little bit. But sometimes, like I was just talking to the guy who produces, I guess would be the term, the show today, and he was listening to an episode. He said, oh, there's a bunch of questions you could have asked. And it didn't occur to me that I could have asked that. So I'm probably going to start asking for feedback before I interview people. Like, what would you want to know if you were talking to this X type person? Because
yeah.
I want to make sure that I don't miss questions. Because he told me some questions that he would have asked a guest when he was listening to it, editing it. And I thought, fuck's sakes, I didn't even think to ask that. So I definitely will be capitalizing on more input.
I always find that I get the best sound bites when the mics are turned off.
Right.
Like at the end.
Yeah.
Do you find that happening a lot as well?
No, because I try and keep the conversation down to a minimum before I interview the guest.
Yeah.
And I very small talky. Sometimes I'll ask them, like, is there anything you don't want to talk about? Most of the guests are either people who are, they're interesting, unusual, or controversial people, right? So they already know that the stuff I'm going to be asking them is like kind of, it's some version of weird, different, or fucked up. So there is no off limits thing. They're usually like, so someone who might hold a controversial opinion about trans issues, for example, they might not want to talk about their childhood, for example, but they'll talk about their views. Or someone who might have a controversial job might not want to talk about their personal life. But I don't really care about that because I'm usually there's a reason I want that particular. Like, I interviewed a doctor in Belgrade recently. The episode hasn't been released yet, who operates a global hub for gender reassignment or gender affirming surgeries. He has been quoted in media sources for talking about people who transition and undergo gender reassignment surgery who regret it and need to detransition, right? And that's a controversial subject because a lot of leftist social justice liberal types and academics even in universities like try and silence it because it goes against the narrative. So I talked to him about that, but I didn't ask him about his personal life,
right?
For example, yeah, we just talked about his work and the research and data he's acquired.
So that episode's yet unreleased?
Yeah.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Well, how many episodes do you record in advance?
Last count, this is a couple days ago, and I added a couple. I've got about 20 in the can that haven't been released yet. Yeah. I record two or three a week.
Yeah, we do this off the seat of our pants, like record on Friday, edit on Sunday, release on Tuesday.
I'm really, like, there's two things for me. I'm neurotic about, I don't want to get stuck one week.
Yeah.
So the neurotic.
It's definitely a fear.
Yeah. And two, it just comes to me and I'm like, oh, let's do it. And I get really enthusiastic. And usually in this day and age, one of the neat things about technology is I can often interview someone over the phone. Now that I've got way better equipment now than when I first started, so I can do really good, pretty good, high quality phone interviews. If they're not doing it, like I recorded an interview with a comedian in Ontario the other night because him and I were chatting online, just shooting the shit back and forth about comedy. He goes, why don't we do that podcast now? And it was like 1 a.m. his time and it was like 10 p.m. my time. I said, yeah, why not? I'm not doing anything. So it was that kind of thing ends up happening. Or the guest, sometimes they're hard to, like the window of opportunity is I can do it this week. That's it.
Yep.
So I just got to rush and do it. So I end up like again, I'll have like two or three recorded in 1 week just because of the time constraints.
Yeah, it's something that I'd like to get better at, as you were saying as well, like not having to prepare so much. I mean, like I've got a couple of pages of notes right in front of me here. I can't imagine just like sitting down and hoping to record something. But I mean, I think some of the best stuff, like even so far in this episode, I think some of the best content that's come out has been from the off-the-cuff questions and other ones that I've written down.
Right. But, one of the reasons I don't have a script per se, I mean, I do want to have a few, like the when my producer, Alex Byron, he did have some good questions, so I don't want to neglect that, but there's a part of me, the way my gut, my instinct, my intuition with the show is I just want to have a conversation like a norm, like if you and I were to just sit down, what would that conversation look like? I probably, in real life, if it wasn't being recorded, what I wouldn't have notes and a set of questions, right? Yeah. But okay, that, I mean, that's not a very good analogy because it is being recorded and people are going to be listening to it. And there is, we only have an hour or 90 minutes to get a bunch of interesting information out. So I do need a bit of a
guideline.
It wouldn't be bad to have some good questions that just in case I didn't think of them. However, I don't ever want the guest to be too uncomfortable because I feel like I'm being given a privilege into their life. So I don't want to have like I told my producer, he said, what'd you think about me giving you some questions? I said, yeah, but never anything confrontational or humiliating. I don't give a shit what they are or how much someone might disagree with their views. I don't want to confront them or humiliate them, right? Because they don't have to be talking to me. I'm not paying them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Often I'm in their home or someone.
So you go to them.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Yeah. I want to make it as convenient as possible for them, right?
Right.
And some of these people are doing things that are not popular. So I got to meet them where they want it, where they're most comfortable with me meeting them, right? So I don't want to ever do anything that rubs them the wrong way because I just feel that's rude. And I have a thing about being rude. Like jokes on stage are totally, that's different. That's comedy, right? But like in person, I don't want to offend people, right? Which sounds funny coming from the offensive comic.
There's a big difference between a dirty comic and a dirty person.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
Yeah.
Because, like, especially with this, with the Me Too movement and stuff, you see people coming out that aren't necessarily known for being confrontational are doing these horrible things in real life.
Right.
And their comedy doesn't always reflect that, like, you know, like a Cosby or like Aziz Ansari or something. Right. And, yeah, and then there's the dirty comics. You never hear about, like, George Carlin or Lenny Bruce abusing people, but...
Richard Pryor beat his wife a couple times, I think, but yeah.
Yeah, obviously there's crossovers.
Yeah, but in my experience, most dirty comics I've ever met, quote-unquote dirty comics, are actually, their personality to a certain degree doesn't reflect their act.
That's where they get the let out, is on stage.
That's what it is. It's sort of these, we're all monsters. Let's put it this way. We're all monsters. All of us have a monstrous side. All of us have an evil side. All of us have a... unsavory side. All of us have a salacious side. How do you cope with that? Where's your outlet? What do you do with it? So for me, I'm someone who's undergone a lot of shit, trauma, abuse, all this kind of stuff, and that's not an excuse. It's just the way it happened. My mind is fucking, my brain is a bit warped from the stuff. I've done a lot of horrible shit. So I've done a lot to kind of overcome all of it and be a better person and da-da-da-da-da. But it's not gone. Those urges and those thoughts and those kind of inclinations and predilections aren't removed from my being. They're just manageable. So for me, I like to be able to be... Okay, it's as easy as this. When you see something, I don't know what... Are you a comic at all? Do you write comedy or...
No, I mean, I'd like to get into it. And this is sort of the first step for me. I'm sort of circumventing the usual process of being a comic. And
okay.
Then, yep. Starting a podcast.
It's one way to do it. So I don't know what your comedic process is, but here, like, when I see an incident of some kind, just my regular friends will say, have a comment about it. I will immediately think of something that's really, like, inappropriate, offensive, hurtful, as in a humorous way, because... I'll admit it, that's just sort of, there is that part of my nature where that's mean-spirited and cruel. Now, if I turn it into a joke and, you know, I try and be as socially appropriate as possible, and then I just do it on stage, I personally don't really see the harm in it. Some people would argue, well, you should never make jokes about certain things. I can't have conversations about that because I fundamentally don't agree with that. I think you can make a joke about anything. It's the rule is always, is it funny? That's it, right? Will it be funny to everybody? No. But so if I see this horrible, tragic accident and I think something fucked up and cruel, is it my fault that I thought that? No. What do I do with that, though? That's and so I, in my particular case, end up writing it down or whisper it to my friend or bring it to my stage or whatever, right? There's my rationalization for everything I do anyway. What does it, could it withstand scrutiny? Beats me, but there it is.
Use comedy as your outlet.
Sort of. It sounds like such a cliche because I don't know if I do or not.
Well,
it's just there it is.
It's a cliche because it works and people do it.
I guess so, yeah.
What do you think you would do instead if it weren't for comedy as an outlet for these
I'd
things?
Probably write or something or... I don't know. That's the thing. This is it. Like for many years,
this is what works.
Yeah, and for many years, I would get in trouble for my sense of humor before I started doing comedy, and it caused me a lot of problems because I'd been in prison for years, and then I get out and I have this fucked up, quote unquote, fucked up sense of humor, and it would cause me social problems, right? And one of the reasons I got into comedy because I was like, why not just do this in a more suitable environment?
Actually, leads into something I wanted to ask you. So most of the stuff I read about you, they're asking you about prison.
Yeah.
Things like that, and you said it's like soldiers don't want to be asked about have they killed someone.
Yeah,
you don't want to be asked about going to prison.
Well, what I don't like being asked about prison is were you raped when you're in there? That's what people always want to know.
It's people like, straight up ask you that
all the fucking time, man. All the time, like were you raped? Yeah.
Well, what I wanted to ask is there a comedy scene in prison?
Yeah, there's like Friday night's open mic. Like, no, just
do people ever do like stand up?
Yeah, you're not allowed to do rape jokes no matter what. They're off limits. No. No, people, but like, we'll be sitting around joking around because, you know, sometimes there's nothing to do. So we'll just be telling stories and then maybe we'll see something and everyone will try and make a joke about it. Sort of like the way a comedy green room is there. That's a good, I've never thought about that before. That's often what it can be like, but there's no like,
this sort of, what is it? What have I written down here? The like recovery program, the recovery comedy.
Yeah. So I get hired to do, stand up in like AA and NA conferences.
Yeah. So do you think that there's maybe, like talking about prison being like a comedy reading room when you exercise like comedically, and do you think there's a possibility that that could be a good rehabilitative process in prison, something like a like comedy classes or...
You know, you make a good point. It could be because it gives anything like that, comedy, art, anything, always is... I've never even thought about that before. Thank you. If you can get someone focused on something they're good at or want to try and be good at, it's always potentially a rehabilitative tool. Because if someone's good, let's just use pottery.
Yeah.
Right? If you're good at pottery, that gives you something to look forward to. It gives you something to do while you're in the joint. Gives you a skill. Then when you get out, it gives you something, a passion to maybe focus on rather than doing dope or doing crime. Right? So it's and there's a lot of creative... untapped creative potential in prison. There's so many super creative people in there. Some of the best tattoo artists in the world are in prison in Canada, actually. They're world renowned, but they can't stay out of prison because they've got drug habits.
Are any of your tattoos from prison?
No. Getting a tattoo in prison is actually a bit of a pain in the ass. That's why I never did it. There's a bit of a process involved in it.
Can you talk about that?
Because you're not I've been out for a few years. This might have changed. You're not allowed to get tattoos in prison. It's against the prison rules. So you got to get someone, you got to pay someone to keep six. Keep six means keep watch for the guards. You got to pay the tattoo artist. You got to get an opportune time to do it. You got to get the gear to do it. It can be done, gets done all the time, but it always just seemed like too complicated for me. And I never got one because some part of me knew my mind isn't where it needs to be making decisions like that about my body. Wait till I get out. And
yeah.
Kind of, because this tattoo, it's okay, I don't regret it, but let's say I didn't have it, would I get it now? No. So but I knew when I got this tattoo, don't get one that you'll regret in 5 years, like skulls and pentagrams, which I would have gotten while I was in prison.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I didn't do that because I would regret that right now.
I mean, I have a few tattoos as well. Sure, don't get one you'll regret in 5 years, but I think if I'm gonna regret it in 10 years, that's fine.
Yeah.
And we just covered a lot of my questions there.
That's the other thing I find about doing my podcast is I often, like, everything ends up getting covered because I kind of try my best
when I'm interviewing guests to let them do most of the talking. Some of my guests have hard to, like, in any other circumstance, it would have been, like, irritating because I couldn't get a word in edgewise. But for the sake of the podcast, it was really good because I didn't need to do any talking.
Well, sometimes I worry that it's going to get silent and I need these prompts as well. But then when it works out like it has so far today, then you have the opposite problem. But do you know about the pastor, Mark Hughes?
Who?
So this is something that's come up a lot. When I do research for people, I find other people with the same names that show up a lot in...
So there's the famous Mark Hughes that I know about. There's a pastor in Winnipeg. Is that what you just said? The pastor?
Yeah, and he's got
Church of the Rock.
He's got a few podcasts himself.
Oh, yeah.
Do you ever get like any crossover with
him? No, none, oddly enough. Yeah. I discovered him when I was in prison. Just
really?
By accident. I was turned on the TV one day and his show was on.
Some people find God. Some people find people with their same names. God.
Yeah. I know a guy who's as related to him. I was on his radio program in Winnipeg, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's totally
Do you think you'll ever meet him?
Hey, you know what? If I ever go to Winnipeg, I might even try to arrange it if I could.
Go on his podcast, have him on yours.
Yeah, why not? That's a good idea.
Well, last week we had Brett Skillen on.
Yeah.
And there is a pastor called Brett Skillen as well, who writes strange religious poetry on Wattpad.
Oh.
And I thought it's like a recurring theme that the people I talk to have these Christian counterparts. What led to you being interviewed by the CBC?
Interesting life, I guess, doing shows about drug addiction and imprisonment.
And they just approach you about
People find out, because I post shit online and stuff, they find out about me, and they're like, first time I was on CBC, it was Now or Never, was because there's a comic I met while I was in Toronto, I'm friends with on Facebook, and she crossed each other's paths on Facebook, and she sees me post jokes about being an addict and all this kind of stuff, and she's like, hey, dude, the fentanyl crisis... the overdose crisis was really just starting to take off and they wanted to cover it. So they wanted to talk to someone who had it. Because I was so open about it and because I posted about it, I was obviously, from a journalist perspective, someone who was a source.
Yeah.
And she just reached out, said, you want to do an interview? I said, yeah, okay. And then it just sort of snowballed from there. I started getting asked all the time. I find with one of the things I've noticed about whenever I'm in the news, one person does an article or something about me, then they all kind of come after
right
that. Like I guess they want to try and take their own angle on it, or you know, they want to make sure they get cover it too. So I've done fundraisers for the overdose stuff too, and I've did a ton of interviews about that.
Obviously now you've made it being interviewed on Comedy Zeitgeist.
Yeah.
What was your journey like from your first comedy class to now?
That's a funny question, because it's not as eventful as you'd think. It's just, you know, you do your first show, you feel really good. Then you go and do another one and it's not as good, but you just go, okay, well, this is, I want to do this. The one thing the class did give me is she did teach us in the class that this takes a long time. Your first show will probably be good because your friends will be there. But after that, you really got to work for it at open mics and stuff like that. So I was aware of that. So I just realized pretty quick that, okay, this takes time to get good at it. So I've just been doing as many mics, open mics and spots as I can in the last 5+ years, and just slowly but surely and incrementally getting better, and you know, doing what I can to have a better online presence, because you have to have that these days if you're going to do anything like that. Making connections where I can, you know, putting on shows, producing the best I can here and there, whatever I can, whatever time I'm willing to sacrifice as far as it goes.
For anyone in CITR, thanks. We've still got lots more to talk about with Mark. You can hear the full episode along with other podcasts on cavegoblins.com. For anyone else, stick around.
You forgot the surfboards? How are we going to shred the gnarly waves now?
Well, I got just the replacement. I picked up some copies of Discorder instead.
Well, it looks like this surf day just got a whole lot better.
This extra special summer issue of Discorder features interviews with local punk rockers Lié, queer Métis fashion designer Evan Ducharme, and the hosts of CITR's Radio Pizza Party. There will also be an exclusive Bartholomew comic strip, short fiction by Mac Gordon, and a suggested summer reading list compiled by the staff of Massey Books.